Okay, thanks, Jay. All right, my name's Junior, I'm an addict. Thanks for asking me to share, and it's always a privilege to do service for Narcotics Anonymous. And I really acknowledge your feelings. You know, I've done a few step forwards now, and I've always felt the same. You know, and I've acknowledged it as, you know, part of the healing that this program provides. You know, kind of the same kind of stuff. I think both my parents are addicts. I was the youngest child of five children. You know, they were all addicts, and it was quite dysfunctional. I can't really remember much of it because I was in a little bubble. You know, and quite scared. I think I've always had that fear. You know, it wasn't until I actually kind of about when I entered this fellowship when I was 38, and actually I realised how scared I really was. You know, previous to that, I had all these misconceptions and misguided belief systems of it being other stuff. You know, don't really need to go into it. It was misguided. You know, so yeah, I've kind of been using from about the age of 9. I've used pretty much everything, and anything that I haven't used is just a yet. You know, I'm not naive enough to think that I'm not capable of allowing this disease progresses for me, and you know, I suffer from a disease of more. Most definitely, I will use anything that you put in my path to get away from me, to get away from my internal condition. You know, I suffer from an internal condition that I try to fix externally, and I'll use whatever I can get. You know, and that's my understanding of what addiction is. You know, don't really want to launch into war stories, but, you know, unfortunately, that is the experience that I had, was using drugs. You know, I'm one of them addicts that done 17 years in prison. You know, my brother died in my arms from this disease. You know, I abandoned and rejected my children. You know, I've had my mum on her knees in tears begging me not to go, not to use, not to die. You know, I caused a lot of wreckage towards myself, but also, and sometimes more importantly, towards other people. You know, and the beauty of this program and what's provided for me as an addict to use a day at a time, life on life's terms, i.e. that, you know, the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous has given me a sense of freedom where I can sit in this room and I'm not scared of any of you. You know, I came here really scared, really fearful. My understanding is we have two emotions, one's fear, one's love. And what I've experienced in the fold of this fellowship is extreme love, even when I was unbearable. When I first came around, I was unbearable. I was unbearable to me. I don't know about anybody else, you know, but I was unbearable to me. And so many loving men and women tolerated me and were patient with me and guided me. You know, I was one of them addicts that came into this room and I thought I knew it all. And I kind of got told the age-old thing, you know, what I knew got me here and it nearly killed me. You know, my experience is that's precisely what happened. Every time I put a drug in my body, especially the last 7 years of my using, I was using for 29 years, you know, the last 7 years of my using, every time I left wherever I was with the intent of getting and finding ways and means to use drugs, I actually wanted to die. You know, my internal condition was that kind of toxic. You know, my self-esteem, my self-worth, my self-respect was non-existent. You know, there wasn't anything that I wouldn't do. I did not sell candy floss when I was using. I would do anything, you know. And I say again, anything I haven't done is just a yet. It's just a yet, you know. But I also know that as long as I stay in the middle of this fellowship and I use what's provided for me, I'm blessed enough not to use a day at a time. And it's that simple. You know, there's nothing special about me. You know, I came into this fold and, you know, as I said, you know, I kind of got a sponsor. My first sponsor's in the room. I acknowledge him, you know, and him along with, you know, my second sponsor who had to move away and the third sponsor that I've got have nurtured me in a way where I strongly believe in what this program provides. And I strongly believe that if I can, anyone can, and also that, you know, the obsession to use for any addict can leave and you can find a new way to live. I strongly believe that, you know. I kind of rewind the tape. You know, I'm an addict that, you know, when I smoke anything, but namely, you know, crack cocaine was the first thing that kind of brought me to my knees. You know, and I'll give you one example. You know, I was smoking crack cocaine in a crack house. where there was no toilet and the bath was used for everything other than washing in, you know, and basically I was smoking crack and I collapsed, didn't know I collapsed, and I came round and my dead brother was in the room and the first thing I did was reach for the pipe and you know, he slapped it out of my hand. And like there was a mirror there, he said, look at your face, look at your face. And basically I'd had a heart attack. And what I basically did from there was I picked the bottle back up anyway, loaded it, and my face was paralysed. I couldn't move my face. And I literally held my lips together around the stem and asked someone else to light it because I couldn't suck with my mouth, you know, and that was the insanity of my using. You know, even when I was kind of experiencing near death, I still wanted to use. You know, and like I said, my brother was in the room and a lot of my using was you know, fundamentally with him. In 2001, I was finishing one of my many, many prison sentences and I came out, and the day I came out, me and my brother thought it would be a good idea to celebrate my release by going into a crack house and smoking crack and heroin. And up to that point, I naively thought that the only way that you could die from drugs is if you put it in a needle and you injected it. I honestly believed that, you know, and now I have an understanding. You know, I believed that when I was smoking cannabis, I wouldn't sniff coke, and when I was sniffing coke, I wouldn't smoke crack. And ironically, when I was smoking crack and smoking heroin, I believed that I wouldn't die as long as I didn't dig it. You know, how untrue is that? You know, 6 hours later, he died in my arms. He had a cardiovascular collapse induced by a paranoid, whatever you call it, it was a paranoid-induced psychosis induced by crack cocaine. His heart and lungs popped, and it took him 45 minutes to die, and it was one of the most horrendous and horrific things I've ever seen a human being experience. And this addict, after getting him in the ambulance and watching him turn blue and getting my mum and running to the hospital, the best thing that I could come up with was to go and take his mobile phone and sell it to a crack dealer and smoke crack. You know, I'm a true addict. You know, I deal with everything that comes my way, good or bad, by using. You know, I'm kind of blessed because today I haven't used a drug and I haven't used another person. You know, and that's something that Narcotics Anonymous has given me, and I stand in that truth. That's my reality. And I acknowledge that without Narcotics Anonymous, that wouldn't be the case. I'd probably be dead. You know, and I said again, you know, in my using, I've done some really horrible things and reckless things. I've caused abandonment and rejection. And sometimes I can sit in this seat and I can talk about me, me, me. But I choose not to do that. Sometimes I feel like I have to talk about the wreckage that I caused to other people. You know, namely my children. You know, I protected this disease, this, you know, my drug use, more than I defended my own children. You know, and it nearly destroyed me. In fact, it did destroy me, you know. Also, I was busy smoking crack cocaine and heroin in a telephone box or a bin chute or wherever else I could find myself sheltered from the wind or the rain. You know, my son was slowly getting an education and became the political liaison's officer for the Houses of Parliament, whilst his dad was smoking crack, you know. And I was really ashamed, and I felt really guilty. And again, because I'm an addict and it's all about me, what I used on that gear, you know. I couldn't find anything positive about myself, and, you know, I just kind of really gave myself a hard time when I was out there using. And, I stayed in victim mode for many, many years. You don't understand. You're not like me. You ain't been through what I've been through, and all that other garbage. And I acknowledge it as garbage. It's absolute rubbish. It's just an excuse. You know, it's just an excuse for me to abandon my life and actually do nothing with it. You know, and just go ahead and, you know, justify and, you know, use a blame thrower and just stay in the belly of the beast, really. You know, and again, I say it's not like that today. And it hasn't been like that for quite some time. You know, today via the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, I found a freedom that was unknown to me. I used to come in this fellowship and I used to hear people talk about a dream beyond their wildest dreams. And I was like, I don't get it. You know, a dream for me was, as you know, as long as I had one and one and my lighter worked, that was my dream. You know, and it was honestly what it was. That's how I felt. You know, I kind of know it's a little bit different today. You know, my dream, you know, my dream today is that, you know, I live one day at a time, I try my hardest not to harm other people, and there, and I don't harm myself. You know, I recognise after step four that, you know, usually when I'm causing harm to other people, usually, you know, the first person to get harmed in that is me. So I kind of try to steer away from it. It doesn't mean that I'm immune from doing it. In no way can I sit here and say that, you know, I don't exist within a perfect working programme. I just have a really humble understanding of what it takes to stay clean, you know, what it takes to slowly become that son, slowly become that father, slowly become that man, you know, and I no longer have to believe that misguided belief system that I first come here armed with. You know, I'm not responsible for my disease, but I am responsible for my recovery, most definitely, and I take full responsibility, and I concede to my innermost self, totally, that without Narcotics Anonymous, I can't stay clean. You know, I've tried many, many methods, and I entered into this fellowship the first time in 1994. I didn't get a day clean until 2006, so I've done a lot of research on how not to get this programme. You know, I've done a lot of not listening. I've done a lot of judging and analysing every word that people are speaking and then just kind of rubbishing it. You know, I've done a lot of that gear. You know, and you know, what happened for me was I was sitting in a prison cell, one of many, and I didn't know it then, but now in hindsight I do. I was spiritually broken. You know, I wouldn't have described it then. I don't know what I would have called it, but I was, you know, I acknowledge that I was spiritually broken. You know, I'd been smoking crack cocaine, and some unknown enemies had gotten through the letterbox, and I jumped out the window, smashed my left leg to pieces, broke my back, got up, scored, used. You know, went to hospital, stayed there for 2 days, got up, walked out, used. So I was kind of sitting in this hotel, yeah, right, this prison cell on the back of a, I think it was a 4-year, 3-month sentence, feeling really spiritually broken, knowing that the minute they open that cell door, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go straight out and I'm going to score. And I knew, I recognised that I needed help, you know, and I'd experienced this fellowship and I'd experienced other things that were kind of set up and geared around, you know, helping addicts get clean. And so I kind of seeked help, and I got the help, and I was sent to an all-male treatment centre, and I needed to be there, you know, and they kind of guided me towards Narcotics Anonymous. I mean, we started doing meetings immediately. As soon as we got there, the first night I was there, we started doing meetings, and I was really glad of that, because my reality was I'd done 6 treatment centres. It was my 6th treatment centre, and my experience, every time I left the treatment centre, I fell flat on my face, you know, and the nightmare continued. So I got to this treatment centre and I kind of engaged with Narcotics Anonymous immediately, and I knew that the only thing that I hadn't done in all 5 previous treatment centres was find something, a solution that maintained any kind of attempt at staying clean. You know, I can get clean, done it many times. My problem was staying clean, you know, and this is what Narcotics Anonymous has given me, the ability to stay clean a day at a time with a really simple programme. Really simple program. I can sit here and I can get it really complicated and try and make myself look really intelligent. And actually, I'm just an addict. I need to humble myself and I need to acknowledge that without Narcotics Anonymous, that's all I'm ever going to be. I'm just going to be an addict, a using one. You know. So yeah, I kind of. Also, another part of something that broke the back of my using was I got a letter from my son, and my son kind of told me how he felt with regards to the abandonment and the rejection that I'd never acknowledged to him, and it was a really hurtful letter, you know, for him to write and for me to read. And he stopped speaking to me for the last 7 years of my using, and to a point where one day I was standing out on Tottenham Court Road in the madness, and, you know, later on I was told this, I didn't even know, my own son stood in front of me and I didn't recognise him, you know, really shameful gear. You know, I would never have been able to sit here 5 years ago and tell you a lot of some of the stuff that I'm telling you. And do you know what? Every time I open my mouth and I say something brutally honest, it keeps my disease at bay. I have no qualms about telling you what my using was about. You know, I came into this fellowship and I met my first sponsor. He was really loving. And, you know, this is one of the main things that I took from this guy. He's in the room. Stop giving yourself such a hard time. stop it, stop beating yourself up. And it took a while for that penny to drop. You know, like I said, both my parents were addicts. 2 years in, you know, my father had become really ill, and this disease kind of robbed him of all his faculties. He was, you know, bedbound. He couldn't move. He couldn't speak. He could barely see. And I, in my heart, couldn't find any remorse for him. And it was described to me as a resentment. I had a massive resentment, and the likelihood of me carrying that for the rest of my life and using it as nothing other than to fuel my internal conditioning to absolute distraughtness was self-evident. And I was advised to try to let it go. I didn't know what it meant. I had no idea what I was talking about. Anyway, what happened for me was I kind of went to the hospital, and you know, I went to visit this man that I felt never loved me and never had a kind word for me and never had anything to teach me that was positive in life. And as I walked into the hospital, I walked down the ward, and you know, as I got closer, I saw this really defenceless, vulnerable person that suffered from the same thing I did. And as I got closer, I saw him recognise me. A smile touched his lips. It spread to his eyes. I kissed him on his forehead, and the resentment that I'd carried for the majority of my life left. And that was my first experience with letting go of a resentment. And it was so poignant that I find it really easy to forgive. You know, before my father died, what he did was he took a phone that belonged to me, and he phoned my son, and he called my son to the hospital. And he hadn't spoken to me for 7 years, and my son came into the hospital, and he told me that all he wanted was a dad. And that's all he'd ever want. And he acknowledged that I was 2 years clean, and he acknowledged that it was going to be really difficult. But he also acknowledged that he loved me and he wanted to be in my life. You know, and that wouldn't have happened without Narcotics Anonymous. Sounds really blasé, you might not believe that, but I'm telling you from now, if I hadn't have been given the love and nurtured in the ways of this fellowship and the 12-step program, I wouldn't have been available, even if I was using or not. You know, there was a lot of times in my early recovery where, without drugs, I was unavailable. Completely unavailable, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. I wanted everything I wanted, and I wanted it now. And I didn't care who I went through. And that didn't change just because I stopped using drugs. You know, and some people started to explain what this thing, Narcotics Anonymous, is really about. It's about the disease of addiction. You know, I can use anything externally to fix this internal condition that I as an addict suffer from, and it doesn't matter what it is. If I want it, I want more of it, and I will do everything in my power to get it. You know, and that can be money, that can be women, that can be absolutely anything. But primarily, it was drugs. You know, so my son walked into the hospital, and he came back into my life, you know, and then my father died, you know, and we buried him, and, you know, it was a really sad moment, very sad moment. You lose someone to this disease, and, you know, you can't really, especially if you lose two people, but, you know, I'm sure there's people in this room that have experienced that too. It's just horrible. It's horrible. You feel so powerless, you know. So I kind of got on with my recovery, and I worked with my sponsor, and I done service, and I stayed in the middle, and you know, kind of experienced the love of this fellowship, you know, and the love of this fellowship was something that I personally thought that I was allergic to. I'd look in the mirror, and I didn't like who was looking back at me, and you know, it kind of reaffirmed to me that, well, if I don't like me, why would any of you? And you did, you know. So unknown faces came into my life, and that's precisely what they did. They loved me, you know, and probably wouldn't have said it that way 5 years ago, but now I can. That's basically what happened to me. The foundation of this fellowship, in my experience, is based in love. If I haven't got nothing loving to say to you, I need to keep my mouth shut. You know, if I've got no experience in what it is you're going through, I need to keep my mouth shut or take guidance from a sponsor, you know. And that's also something that's really important to me, and it's like, you know, the loving guidance of a sponsor, someone that I trust, someone that I had to learn to trust. You know, it was said to me that trust is like a muscle, it needs exercise, you know, and by the time I got to step 4 and 5, you know, I entirely trusted that sponsor, you know, and trusted him enough that when he moved away, what I did was, because I wanted to continue going over the work, I got one of his sponsees to sponsor me, because I truly believed in the methods that were being used, and I believed in the purity of what was being taught to us, and I abide by that, and I stick to that, and, you know, so, kind of, yeah, when my dad died, I was 2 years clean, my dad died, and in that week, my dad died, my girlfriend used, and I had my first bone graft and was crippled from the knee down, and I didn't use. And members of this fellowship picked me up from my house, fed me, brought me to meetings, took me home, and every time it happened, I was absolutely gobsmacked. I did not believe that I deserved the way that they were treating me. Gave myself a really hard time, you know, and full of guilt and shame, completely consumed by self-obsessed fear, you know, and they loved me and they treated me in that way, and it kind of steered me in good stead, because ultimately what they taught me was how to treat other people when they come into this fellowship. You know, treat them lovingly. Do more for others than you do for yourself, despite yourself. You know, and fundamentally be loving. You know, I come from a place of extreme violence. You know, 17 years behind the door, I've been stabbed, I've been shot, been robbed, I've robbed. I've done all that horrible stuff, and I've had it done to me. You know, and today I'm a million miles away from that. You know, I haven't used for quite some time. You know, I definitely suffer from the disease of addiction. You know, it manifests itself in other ways. You know, it raises its ugly head daily. Some days I'm free of it. More days now than others. You know, I have this kind of freedom from self. That it's not something that I can explain to other people. It's just something that I've experienced. And if I try to put it into words, I don't think it would pay much service to it. You know, I'm an addict that I believe in a conscious contact with a power greater than myself. I've had to practice it. Really difficult stuff for me, because, you know, I came into this fellowship an atheist. I didn't believe. I did not believe. You know, I believed in something, but it was more the devil than it was God. You know, and what I did was I got on my knees despite myself, because people told me to, and I liked what they were experiencing, and I liked what they was benefiting, and you know, it weren't going to work me if I just got down on my knees and talked to something outside of myself. And you know, the first thing that I used was my brother, kind of connected with my brother, and, you know, and that was a really good thing for me to use. You know, 6.5 years later, kind of have a really loving relationship with my family, and a really, really close, loving relationship with my son. You know, and close enough for a young man who's kind of gone in a totally different direction from me, and who's actually scared of the lifestyle that I come from. When he sees that lifestyle, he's like, he doesn't like it, you know. And for the last 2 years, he's kind of been trying to tell me something. And it's not that I haven't been available, he just couldn't find the right moment. And I don't think that, if it wasn't for this fellowship, I don't think he would have ever said what he said to me. But ultimately, my son told me he was gay. 27-year-old man. Came to me and sat down with his father. I needed to speak to me. He asked me to come to him. I sat down and he told me he was gay. And, you know, I was blown away. I wasn't blown away by the fact that he was telling me he was gay. I was blown away by the fact that I was available for that and that he needed to tell me, you know, and that I mattered enough for him to need to tell me. You know, and I'm really proud of him. I really love him. He's, you know, he's amazing. He's a lovely guy, you know, and... I'm just waiting to meet my son-in-law. So I imagine that he's a lovely one too. You know, but it's all not, it's not all joy. You know, I have a son, I have a son, I also have a daughter. You know, she's 20 years of age and she doesn't want to know me. You know, I live in hope, I live in faith. I continue to try and build these bridges towards my daughter. You know, someone told me a story, and someone that I love really deeply is my cousin. He's got, you know, decades of clean time, and he told me a story about what this fellowship really represents with regards to how long it is that it takes sometimes for us to clear the wreckage of our past. And it's a story about an old man in a garden. And, you know, the old man tends to his garden and he grows lilies and he grows loads of beautiful flowers, roses, and, you know, a guy's walking past the garden one day and he kind of looks and he, you know, he thinks to himself, that garden's beautiful. And the old man's there tending to his garden and looks like he's in a place of his own, you know, looks really peaceful, you know. And the next day the guy passes again and the old guy acknowledges him and he goes over and he admires the garden. And in that garden, you know, he sees these flowers that are really well tended to and the bushes that are really well pruned, you know, and the guy's taken a lot of responsibility and maintained his garden, you know. And the next day he goes past again and the old boy invites him in for a cup of tea and he's sitting in the house drinking this lovely cup of tea and he looks out the back window and what he notices, the garden, the back garden's full of weeds, you know. And and that's basically what this program represents to me. And I can externally project to you that I'm okay. But unless I allow myself to be vulnerable in this fellowship and tell the truth about what I did, where I come from and where I am today, ultimately my internal condition just stays like a garden full of weeds. And that's what this program's about for me. It's to treat this internal condition that I as an addict suffer from. It's about the damage that I'm capable of doing to myself and other people. I don't want to do that stuff. And the only solution, the only thing that I've ever found that's actually treated that with a spiritual solution is Narcotics Anonymous. I've been everywhere searching for this gear. And all along it was under my nose. It was under my nose and I just wasn't listening. You know, kind of feel really humble in this fellowship. I don't feel scared anymore. You know, I'll walk out of here tonight, I'll go home to my family and we're going to go out and celebrate a birthday. You know, I don't live in London anymore. You know, I don't like London. That's my truth. I don't have to like London. You know, I live on the seaside, beautiful place that's really quiet and there's lots of old people and it's just me and my dog. You know, and I'm quite happy like that, you know. I used to think that I was attracted to pain and chaos. When I first came around, I honestly believed that I was attracted to pain and chaos. And bless him, again, it was my son that brought it into perspective. And what he said to me is, okay, so does that mean that if you go and you go to get on a bus to get to a destination, that you immediately believe that that bus is going to crash? You know, I was talking to him about relationships. Wow. You know, I've had a few of them and... So, yeah, anyway. You know, I was talking to him about relationships and how confusing I found them. You know, and he acknowledged and he said to me, you know what, Dad, you might think that you find relationships confusing, but you've done really well with me. And I've seen you do really well with other members of your family. You know, maybe it's just something that you need to stick at and you need to just kind of work out. And I said to him, well, I think I'm attracted to pain. I always seem to go towards... Not that I'm blaming you, but go towards females that are painful. Or, you know, obviously it's something that I'm bringing into the relationship too. I acknowledge that. I take responsibility for my part. You know, and what he said to me, he kind of gave me that. He said to me, so are you telling me that every time you looked at a female that you fancy and you thought that you'd want to be in a relationship with her, it's only because you thought she was going to bring you a world of pain? And I was like, well, no. He said, well, how are you attracted to pain then? You're not. It's just stuff that you're doing in the relationship. And you need to work on it. You know, and this is coming from my son. This is coming from my son, and I've actually found it in the literature. Page 112 in the Step Working Guide quite clearly tells me, it quite clearly tells me in Step 11 that if I go into a relationship and seek to change another person and don't accept them for who they are, chances are in self-will, I'm going to come up against a problem. You know, and it's about defects of character in that. You know, I worked in the engine room with 6 and 7 and I acknowledge my defects of character and, you know, I'm never totally free of them. But I have an ability and a solution via this program to actually work on them. You know, what else? Wow, I'm nearly drying up. Okay. You know, recently I found out that, you know, after 3 bone grafts to my left leg, and, you know, these 3 bone grafts were like 6 months in a cast, a year on a stick. You know, the first one failed. I had to have it done all over again. I had it done 3 times. And ultimately, for the last 6.5 years, throughout my recovery, I've had to use some really strong painkillers. And when it first started happening to me, I kind of just want to talk about this because I know that, you know, there's probably other people in this room that are maybe experiencing what I experienced around it. You know, and there were some loving people in this fellowship that told me that I wasn't a martyr and that I needed to take guidance from doctors and that, you know, it was okay. And there was other people that told me that I'd relapsed when I was using painkillers, which is a load of rubbish. You know, it's in our literature, you know, as long as it's medically provided and it's for the right reasons, you know, it's okay. You know, and 6.5 years later, I kind of still suffering from upper body pains. I didn't quite know what was going on. I changed my GP and the new GP sent me for an X-ray and I discovered that it wasn't only my leg that was broken, I had a broken back. And my head went nuts, went absolutely nuts. He was offering me tramadol, codeine phosphate, blah, blah, blah. And I was sitting in the chair thinking, it's not enough. It's not enough. Because the minute I knew that my back was broken and they put some form of understanding into what was actually wrong with me, because up to that point I thought I was mad. I thought I was making it up. You know, and immediately I wanted some compensation, and that compensation needed to be the strongest painkiller that he had. You know, and what I did was I walked out of there asking him to send me to a pain clinic, because I knew that ultimately my disease was trying to take me, and you know, if I would have allowed myself to accept any form of medication from that doctor on that day, chances are it would have gone seriously wrong for me. You know, so I've engaged in a pain clinic and I've got some really professional people that acknowledge that actually when you're in physical pain, just, you know, in recovery, out of recovery, human beings in physical pain, usually what can happen is we push people away from us. Mm-hmm. We get really isolated and we get really scared again, you know, and I have to admit and I have to acknowledge that it put my back against the wall quite a few times, but I haven't used, you know, and that's what it's about for me. You know, if you're an addict and you're sitting in this room and you've never been in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting before, welcome. You know, if you're suffering from an internal condition, i.e. if you feel inside really lost and really kind of scared and really abandoned, you're in the right place. That's how I felt when I got here. And with some love of this fellowship and with some really loving men and women and family members, I don't feel like that anymore. You know, via working the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous in my life, not just writing them, you know, acknowledging that I need to work them in my life and actually experiencing the benefits that I get from doing that, I feel free. You know, and I never believed that I could ever get a day clean. I never believed that I'd ever be sitting here acknowledging that, you know, externally I may have some problems going on, but internally I feel spiritually blessed. You know, I kind of feel really wealthy in that way. And if you knew me 10 years ago, you'd probably acknowledge that as well. I was a horrible little shit, you know, and I don't like the person I was. I have no intentions of allowing myself to revert to that type of character again, but I also know that I can only achieve that by working this program a day at a time, you know. When I walked into this meeting, at first I felt slightly unnerved because I've never been in this meeting before. And, you know, someone asked me to come here last week to kind of have a look around and see what he's like. I was like, no, because if I do, I'm going to get nervous. I'm going to get nervous and it's just not going to do me any favours. You know, and when I walked into this room, you know, within the first 3 minutes, I kind of got acknowledged with love from at least 20 different people. And that's been my experience no matter where I go. You know, I've done convention shares and, you know, really, really rattled with fear. And I've just had one person come up to me, like Kim was talking about, one person come up to me and told me that they loved me. And it just left. You know, in this fellowship, I'm alive. I don't have to be scared. I don't have to lie. I'm allowed to be me. I can be loving. I can be emotional. I can be empathetic. I can be caring. You know, and I can show that to men and women. And it's okay. You know, and I do. You know, I've learned to love myself in this fellowship. I don't pluck my eyebrows, but I've learned to love myself. You know, You know, when I first came around, when I was brushing my teeth, I looked in the sink. Today I look in the mirror. You know, I'm no longer scared of my own shadow. I'm no longer scared about what other people will think of me when they find out what I was capable of in my using. You know, and I'll end it on this, the same way I started it. I'm not responsible for my disease, but I am definitely responsible for my recovery. And whilst I take responsibility for my recovery, I'm free from this disease and its catastrophe and its wreckage one day at a time. And I believe, strongly believe, that as long as I adhere to that, as long as I do this daily, you know, and I do it humbly, that I'll be okay. And that, you know, the pain that I cause to other people will not continue. and it, you know, and the pain that I caused to myself will not continue. You know, so it's been a privilege to share. Thank you. I'll leave it there.